watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last weekend, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the IVAW, presented 3 days of testimony from veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, Iraqis, journalists, military families, and scholars, to bring largely unreported truths to the public and support the growing movement of GI resistance. They called the event Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, in homage to the first Winter Soldier Tribunal held in 1971 that was organized by Vietnam veteran war resistors to bring to the public direct testimony of systemic war crimes by the U.S. military through the eyes of those who'd been there. One generation later, another group of young Americans has had to confront that they have been called to serve a lie, have been transformed into monsters by greedy old men seeking power and empire over other people's dead bodies. Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan was carried live over many radio stations by my beloved alma mater, Pacifica Radio. And many of you may have had the opportunity to hear it on your station. But I know that it was not heard everywhere, certainly not on my home stations here in the Finger Lakes. Owing to the importance of this event, I'm going to dedicate the next month of shows to bringing you a selection of the testimony that peels back the lies, one voice at a time. I'd like to thank the Pacifica Radio crew and Chief Engineer Michael Yoshida for making these recordings available. The entire event will be available on streaming video at ivaw.org, where you can also find out more about how to become a member or supporter of the GI Resistance. We'll begin with the testimony of former Sergeant Christopher Goldsmith.
My name is Sergeant Christopher Sean Goldsmith. And what I'm here to talk to you about today is prisoners of war. And these are prisoners that most of America does not know about. I'd like to say the following names: Staff Sergeant Keith Matthew Maupin, Specialist Alex Jimenez, and Private Byron Foudy. Those are who the DOD has listed on their website as the confirmed captured prisoners of war. What the DOD does not list on their website is the countless names of soldiers and Marines and other service members who are victims of what they call stop loss. Stop loss was enacted by Congress to be used by the military in a time of war, a time of national emergency, to ensure the combat readiness of the military. And the really broad description of this war on terror allows the military to keep people like myself and my friends, veterans who've been there once, twice, been there five times, been there 3 years or 32 years. It allows the military to breach that contract and hold them in until the military sees fit to let them go. I'm here to tell you about my experience with stop loss, and the military, how the Army let me down. This is a picture here of me when I was about 10 years old, wearing all camo, having a pair of dog tags, and giving my Boy Scout salute. That boy died in Iraq. This is the proud soldier who enlisted just after Christmas in 2003 to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That boy is dead. I'm from Belmore, a town in Long Island, New York, 20 minutes out of Manhattan. I could see the smoke when the towers fell on September 11th. On September 12th, I remember standing up in a pizza restaurant and telling everyone about how I wanted to kill everyone in the Middle East, how the Middle East should be turned into a glass plate by nuclear weapons, because that's what I believed. That's what the media had trained me to believe. The media had created a racism inside of me that was unjust. I joined the Army to kill people. I signed up as a forward observer, one of the most dangerous, powerful jobs in the military. My job was to go out and basically annihilate the enemy when we received contact. I was in control. I was authorized to use mortars, artillery. That's what I was trained for. MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, capable of destroying a grid square, which is 1,000 meters by 1,000 meters. A lot bigger than a city block. I was 19 years old when I was deployed to Iraq. And I spent the first 8 months in Sadr City, which is what everybody who has been in Baghdad considers the slums of Iraq. It's a place that has been neglected not only by Saddam Hussein, but is horribly neglected by America right now. The people there hate us, and the reason why is because when we went there, we promised them freedom and we promised them help. We promised to get them clean water, to get them food, to get them jobs. But all that I saw over there now, all that I saw over there in 2005 and all that there is now is 2 to 4 hours of electricity a day, randomly. Sewage that leaks into their fresh water system, if you want to call it fresh. A water treatment plant which hasn't been finished. It was barely even worked on the entire year that I was set in Iraq. I never personally saw any contractors of any country working on that water treatment plant outside Sadr City in 2005. We discovered it. My battalion discovered it and reported up, and we were told to ignore the fact that nothing was going on there. It was a sector between companies, between battalions, between brigades. And it wasn't within our area of operation, so don't be concerned with what goes on there. After going to Iraq, I quickly learned that it wasn't at all like I thought it was going to be. The people of Iraq were not grateful for us liberating them. They were angry because we were oppressing them. We gave them a curfew and told them that if they came out at night, they'd be arrested, sometimes physically abused. They were often harassed. And these would be people who were driving their pregnant wife to the hospital. They'd be rushing them to the hospital, and we would stop them and search their car, regardless of the fact that their wife was in labor. That happened on multiple occasions. That wasn't a one-time occurrence. That wasn't just my platoon. That wasn't just my company. That was my entire battalion all throughout Sadr City, and I'm sure it happened throughout the rest of Iraq. Imagine living in a place where it gets up to 150 degrees. You don't want to go out during the day. You want to stay in the shade. And at night, American soldiers are rolling around your streets telling you that you can't go outside and you can't talk to your friends, you can't enjoy yourself. You can't gather outside the coffee house or the chai shop because if you go out past dark, you're committing a crime. So essentially, during the summer months, Sadr City was a prison. 3.2 million people in Sadr City were prisoners of war. I graduated basic training at the top of my class. I graduated Warriors Leaders course, which is the new platoon leadership development course, an NCO course, non-commissioned officers, of course, with a 94% grade point average. I was on the commandant's list. I received a memoration of commendation from Command Sergeant Major Commandant Committee, Mitty A. Smith, for scoring a 315 in my physical fitness test. I was a great soldier once upon a time, and now I stand here to fight for my brothers more than I ever could while I wore a uniform. I'd like you to play the first video, please.
The video is
what you
showing.
See here is civilian Iraqis exhuming bodies of murdered and tortured Iraqis. We don't know why they were killed. We weren't really trying very hard to find out. We found over a dozen bodies that day. And my job, because we weren't authorized artillery, became the intel reporter. So I was forced to take pictures of these dead bodies. I was told for the sake of identity, so that we could try to identify them. But there was no identification process. I never went around with those pictures printed up to the police stations to post them and see if we could find out who they were. You'll see me in a couple seconds standing with another soldier who's on top of the pickup truck, lifting up the faces of the Iraqi bodies to take pictures of them. All these pictures were taken for is trophies of war for people who didn't have to experience that death. People made videos to send home to their friends and family to brag, to say this is what happens to Iraqis and this is what the war looks like and it's cool. When people ask me, you can start going through the next bunch of pictures. When people ask me, hey man, you want to go see Saw 4 or whatever's out? I tell them no, because this is what I see when I watch those movies, and I can't bear to be reminded of that. This is what we nicknamed the Faces of Death. And it was a joke while I was over there. But while I was taking those pictures, I never looked directly at the bodies. What I did was I held the camera out in front of me. I had a digital camera. I held it out in front of me, and I looked at the 2.5-inch screen, and I flashed that photo. And as that flash went off, that image was burned into my mind. Every one of these pictures is burned into my mind. I remember I could draw them to the T. You'll see an image of a man having his face lifted up and his coagulated blood falling out of his nose. That coagulated blood slinged off his body, off his face, onto my shoe. And that was the most repulsed I had ever been. There were flies. It was May 15th, 2005. Very hot, uncomfortable, miserable day. I'll never forget it. There were flies landing on the corpses. And the flies are there, regardless of death, they're just looking for moisture. And they would land on my lips. They would land on my eyes. They would crawl into my nose. I felt so violated and emotionally raped to to have to be put through this. And then the intelligence that I gathered was not used to help the Iraqis. It was used to build morale, to say that killing is right, death is right, dead Iraqis is a great thing. And that's wrong. If you could go through those slides a little quicker and get to the last one in particular, please. That's the faces of death right there. These are the images that are burned into my mind that I'm reminded of when I play video games or walk into a movie that I shouldn't have seen. This is somebody's brother. This is somebody's husband. This is somebody's son. This is somebody's cousin. And the only reason that we're desensitized to it is because they're not white. They're not American soldiers. That right there is the man who bled on my foot. A little faster, please. Just get to the last one. That right there, flip back to that last one. That right there, I specifically asked my command, and it was radioed up. I said, this man is missing his face. There is no skin left on his head. And they said, take the picture anyway. Not to identify him. Whoever was on the other end of the radio just wanted to see the picture. And now, because of that person, I'm left with that image. I'd like to read an achievement off of my Army Commendation Medal that I received for my service in Iraq. Achievement number 3. PFC Goldsmith was directly responsible for... While on patrol of Alpha Company's AOR in Sadr City... The platoon was called upon to reinforce Iraqi Army Battalion in Sector 48. PFC Goldsmith's initiative and timely placement of his weapon system at a key intersection helped ensure the effective blocking of Sector 48. This allowed the Iraqi Army Battalion to fix and destroy enemy insurgents in the area without any insurgents escaping the objective. I'd like to tell you exactly what happened that day. Yeah, what you heard was true. Well, what they left out... is that I was standing in a 3-man position by a truck, a Humvee, in an alleyway with my platoon sergeant. My platoon sergeant claimed that he saw an insurgent and fired upon that man. He was wearing all black, and it is unknown if he got hit, if he was killed, wounded. And because of that, because of the highest enlisted ranking man in my unit or in my platoon was able to fire his weapon, I knew that it was game on. Not I could get away with anything. There was a little boy on an alleyway to my left on top of a building, a little boy who hated American soldiers, and he was holding up a stick as if to mock having an AK-47, and he was pointing it at me, pretending to shoot. I trained my weapon on him. I positively identified my target. I trained my weapon on him. And thought for a couple minutes, I hate these Iraqis. I hate these kids who throw rocks and bricks at me. This is my chance. I can kill this kid just to take one out of the couple million of them out. It took me a lot of thinking to not pull that trigger that day. I could have killed a 6-year-old boy. I could have killed someone's son. But I didn't. But I was put in that position. I was put in that position by the United States occupation of Iraq and the media creating this hatred for Iraqis. When I came home from Iraq, all I did was drink. I'm a severe alcoholic, and so was just about everybody who lived in the barracks with me. We used to go out every Friday, Saturday night, and I would have a 1.75 liter bottle of vodka, and I'd just about finish it. And I blacked out every time. That was my goal. I wanted to black out. I was self-medicating because we were told that if we were to seek mental health, we would be locked away and that our careers would not advance. If I admitted that I had severe chronic depression, if I thought I had PTSD or anything like that, my career could have been ruined. The only thing that I had to look forward to was getting out of the military and going to college. I had learned my lesson the hard way, that I should have gone to college, should have got an education, and should never have seen the ugly face of war. And that hope was taken away from me on January 10th, 2000, 2007, when George Bush stood in front of Congress and gave his State of the Union address, where he announced that he was going to send an additional 20,000 to 30,000 troops into the sandbox. And my unit was the 5th Brigade of the 5 to be locked down with stop loss. No one could leave to re-enlist, to go somewhere else, to avoid the deployment. No one could escape the military. People who were ready to retire, set to retire 2 months from then, were locked into an 18-month deployment under some of the worst conditions since the initial invasion. Those 20,000 to 30,000 troops that Bush sent over didn't have homes waiting for them. They slept in the dirt. They slept in metal connexes. They slept in houses that had been abandoned. They slept in what they called Al-Qaeda training camps, which is something I want to mention. When I was over there in 2005, I didn't see Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wasn't there. DOD says different. They weren't there. Al-Qaeda had no connections to Saddam Hussein. I invite everyone in the military, everyone who has been in the military, everyone who is thinking of joining the military, to read this book, Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War, by Michael Isikoff and David Korn. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but read it for yourself and find your own truth. So from the time that I found out that I was stop lost, I went from the happiest I had ever been in my life, because I felt this sense of relief that I was going to be released from this prison that was called the Army, to the most depressed, sharpest, most anguishing downward spiral that I ever could imagine anyone going through. I was set to deploy the same week that I was set to get out of the Army, according to my contract, and that was in May of 2007. The day before I was supposed to deploy, Memorial Day, I went out onto a field in Fort Stewart where there's a memoriam, a tree planted for every soldier in the 3rd Infantry Division who has died. I went out among those fallen soldiers, and I tried to take my own life. I took pills, and I went back to my regular poison of vodka and drank until I couldn't drink anymore. The next thing that I knew, I was handcuffed to a gurney in the hospital. The cops had found me and literally dragged my body into an ambulance, threw me in there, and locked me up. I spent a week on a mental ward. Now, mind you, I had been diagnosed because I had finally sought mental health because I thought I was having a heart attack. I believed myself to be strong. And after finding out I was stop lost, I started having panic attacks, and I couldn't admit that I was mentally or emotionally broken. So I went into the hospital complaining of chest pain. They had me seek a mental health professional. They diagnosed me with depression and anxiety disorder and adjustment disorder. But I was still set to deploy. I was obviously a broken soldier, and I was still set to deploy. After trying to kill myself, I was locked up and analyzed and saw doctors and this and that. And when I got out of the mental ward, I was told that I was going to be removed from the military in a quick, comfortable way. Within 2 weeks, I could be home. So I was ecstatic. It was great. And in the meantime, I was allowed finally to go to mental health meetings as often as I would like, which was every single day. But during these mental health meetings, I say meetings, not sessions, because it wasn't one-on-one with the psychiatrist. It was one psychiatrist and 20 to 25 at any given time. Soldiers, wives of soldiers, children of soldiers, who all had completely separate problems. Now, anyone who's studied psychology or knows anything about psychology, you don't give therapy on a broad, broad way of just saying, everyone with problems, get in a room, no matter what your problem is, and we're all going to discuss it. So none of that helped. I had tried before my attempt at suicide, and it didn't work. It didn't make me feel better. It didn't make me feel ready to get deployed against my will. They tried to prosecute me for malingering. I wasn't diagnosed with malingering. The doctors said that I had a severe problem and that they recommended removal from service. But my commander, Captain Mello, who was deployed, not directly commanding my rear detachment, who I currently fell under, decided that that I should be removed from the country and I should have the stripes on my uniform. I was a sergeant after just over 2 years. I should have the stripes stripped. They should take money from me, possibly put me in jail. And when I went to legal counsel, the military lawyers on Fort Stewart, and I asked for help to fight this Article 15 non-judicial punishment from my commander, they said, no, you need to give up this fight because people try to fight it and all it does is bring down the military and blah, blah, blah. And I was refused help by the legal attorneys because they were wearing bars and they were wearing oak leaves on their collars because they were officers and they didn't want to be slanderous to the military. They didn't want to bring down their own career by supporting me in fighting what was wrong, an illegal order to void my contract. And they called that stop loss. It's not something that's fair. Right now, endstoplossnow.com reports 80,000 troops locked into stop loss right now. DOD, or the Army Times, reported last week that there was only 7,000. Now, the reason why I think this is a very low number is because you're faced with the option, if you know that you're going to fall under stop loss and your contract is going to be extended, you say, well, hell, I may as well just re-enlist, so at least I get a bonus. When you're stop loss, you don't get any extra money. There's no compensation for voiding your contract. Nothing like that. I was eventually removed from the military on one of the happiest days of my life, August 16th of 2007, on a general discharge. My DD-214, the paperwork which states my entire, every accomplishment of my military service, says in nice big bold letters, misconduct, serious offense. I committed a serious offense by trying to kill myself because I was so damaged by the war, the occupation in Iraq. It was misconduct for me not to get on the flight while I was chained or handcuffed to a bed in the hospital. So I lost my college benefits. The one thing that really gave me hope in life that I was looking for. You know, I was going to be a student. I didn't know where. I didn't know what I was going to study, but I knew I was going to college in September of 07. That didn't happen. Now I can't pay for it. My money is disappearing. Between VA visits and personal instability, I've found it extremely hard to find a job. Tell you the truth, I haven't really looked because I'm having a rough time. So I deliver pizzas on Wednesdays. That's what I am now, a pizza delivery boy. I was a sergeant. I was a leader. I was a trainer. I was very well thought of. I was one of the most professional soldiers that I ever met. And I mean, I got the paperwork right here in front of me if anyone ever wants to see it. I was a very good soldier. But now I'm pizza delivery boy who works once a week because that's the only job where I can call in a couple hours before and say, I'm still at the VA. I'm waiting in line. I'm sorry, I can't come in for a couple hours. Going back in time a little bit, please show the next couple slides. That is what stop loss does. This man, who asked to remain nameless, is a friend of mine who I traveled to North Carolina to see on my way home. Go through the slides a little faster. What happened was he stepped on a pressure plate, an anti-personnel mine, and he almost lost his right leg. He had arterial bleeding in his right arm, his left leg, his right leg. He lost all his hearing. His eardrum is destroyed in his right ear. This man was supposed to get out of the Army the same week that I was, the same week that our unit deployed. So I'm faced forever with, that could have been me. Or if I were there, maybe things could have been different. This is someone who was in my platoon, I served with for a year. I knew him very, very well. When I came into the hospital and I was feeling guilty about killing myself or trying to kill myself, what this man said to me as soon as I walked in the room was not, hey, how you doing? Not, dude, you're a bad person for not coming over there with us or whatever. He looked at me with an intense look in his eyes, and he said, dude, you're not going over there, right? And that filled my heart with something that no one else could have done.
Thank you.
All right, I'll wrap up. The military commanders, they held me accountable for not deploying and for trying to kill myself and being weak, basically, being emotionally and mentally broken. Major Wesner, Captain Mello, Lieutenant Colonel Adji, First Sergeant Titu, and Sergeant Major Altman, I have one message for you. And that is something that is internationally understood across the world. And that's this. Peace.
Former Sergeant Christopher Goldsmith testifying March 16th, 2008 at Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan. 3 days of testimony on the invasion and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan from eyewitnesses organized by the IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. The remainder of this week's program will present a panel of veterans and journalists on the topic of corporate pillaging and military contractors.
And we begin the panel with Kelly Daugherty, the Executive Director of Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Deployed twice, once to the Balkans and once to Iraq as military police. When my unit, the 220th Military Police Company from the Colorado Army National Guard, got orders to deploy to Iraq, I was actually serving in a headquarters detachment as a medic and was involuntarily transferred to the military police company to be deployed to first Kuwait and then later to Iraq as a military police sergeant. We arrived in Kuwait on February 22nd of 2003, before the invasion started, and went into Iraq late March of 2003 and stayed there until February of 2004. During the time that I was in Iraq, our unit did primarily two different missions. One was convoy escort, and the other was patrols. And one of the main things that we were tasked with was to escort convoys of KBR, or Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a major U.S. contractor that the military is employing in Iraq to do a variety of different jobs. And we escorted their vehicles from fuel tankers, flatbed trucks, trailer trucks, from Kuwait, bases on Kuwait, to various military bases in Iraq that were going from base to base to bring fuel and supplies to the different bases. Late August or early September in 2003, our patrol route changed and became much more just doing patrols and not doing as many convoy escorts north of where we were. And when we started moving more towards that mission, one of the things we started seeing a lot more of were problems with the KBR trucks, that they would break down a lot, they would get in accidents a lot. And so one of our main jobs as military police was to secure the vehicles from the Iraqi civilians so that they wouldn't loot them. For us, as military police, we're told when we get into Iraq and when we're getting on these convoy missions that these trucks, they're a U.S. asset, they're something that needs to be protected with force, deadly force if necessary, because it's a strategic asset to our military presence in the country. Initially, when we would escort the convoys in southern Iraq and they would break down, a lot of times it was not a very populated area. It was pretty remote and sparse. So we would let the drivers try to fix the vehicles if they could. Sometimes they were able to after a lot of waiting around. But then when we started patrolling further north, it became much more densely populated. There were a lot of villages. Basically, there are two main supply routes that the U.S. military uses in southern Iraq, and the first is called MSR Tampa, or Highway 1, and that's a large highway in the south. But as you go north, many convoys were rerouted to MSR Jackson, which is much smaller. It's a two-lane road that goes through a lot of villages, a lot of cities, pretty much all the way up to Diwaniya, which is south of Baghdad, was where all of these convoys would drive on MSR Jackson, and where we were tasked to patrol and to guard the convoys if they would break down or get stuck in the mud or have a traffic accident. What we did repeatedly, and it got to be pretty much on a daily basis when we were on patrols in that sector, when a KBR truck would break down, the standard procedure for the convoy is that you don't stop the convoy because it has to keep going. There are a lot of people and vehicles around. If a whole convoy stops, this could be dozens of semi-trucks all driving slowly in a row, and when you stop, it creates a huge traffic problem and also makes a target out of everyone in those vehicles that are stopped. So when the truck would break down, a driver would jump out, get into another vehicle, and go, and then leave the vehicle there, and we would get called out to guard it. And, of course, these were populated areas, and there were a lot of Iraqi civilians who were living in abject poverty who would come and try to get things off of the vehicles and loot them, whether it was for the cargo that was on the vehicles. A lot of time they were fuel tankers or the tires or the doors, or pretty much strip the entire vehicles and use whatever they could, even if it was just scrap metal, to use or to sell. So we would go there to guard the vehicles. A lot of times we would get into physical altercations and the escalation would rise between us and the civilians. It was definitely one of those experiences where you just feel apprehension every day going out because you know you're probably going to have to get into a crowd control situation that day, and you're just kind of waiting for that time when someone in the crowd fires an AK-47 or something like that, because we knew that many Iraqis were armed and were just kind of anticipating that to happen. Luckily, in our instance, That had never happened with me or my team. But what would happen is we would wait there, radio back, say, you know, we have a KBR truck broke down here and we need someone to come in and recover it. And a lot of times it would be things like flat tires or just different mechanical things, or they would just, like I said before, be stuck in the mud or something like that. So we would be guarding these against civilians, and the crowds would always get bigger and bigger, and we were trying to keep them back and trying to keep them back, and we couldn't communicate with them. And then eventually what would happen is we would get a call back on the radio saying, well, they can't get anyone to come out and recover the vehicle, so just leave it. And so we were getting these two very conflicting set of orders. One, this vehicle is a U.S. asset. It's worth protecting, even if it means killing someone else to keep them away from it. And then B, all that stuff we just told you, never mind. Just leave the vehicle, continue with your mission. And that was a pretty much daily occurrence some of the weeks that we were patrolling, specifically in the fall and winter of 2003 and into 2004, where we were abandoning vehicles by KBR contractors on a daily basis. And it was very frustrating for us because we knew the drill, we knew what would happen, we knew we would get called out, have to guard these vehicles, keep the civilians back, and then would just leave them. And many times before we left the vehicles, we would be ordered to destroy them so that the Iraqis couldn't use them or couldn't drive them or couldn't use the stuff that was on them. And so one particular incident I remember was I was with my team, which were two other military police officers and another team, and there were two fuel tankers, and they had got into an accident, and they were off the side of the road, and they were both full of diesel fuel, and there were Iraqis from the local village, hundreds of Iraqis on the perimeter waiting to get the fuel from these vehicles. And the area that we were in, of course, in all of Iraq, the regular people there don't have access to fuel. Like, they can't just go to the gas station. They have to stand in lines and wait in lines and push their cars because they're out of gas in fuel lines that stretch for miles just to get some inflated, expensive fuel. So here we were with two huge fuel tankers. And at this time, we'd been issued what we call less than lethal ammunition. These are things like rubber bullets and concussion grenades and beanbag shots for the shotgun. So we were there doing crowd control, keeping people back from these fuel tankers. Escalations were the tension was really rising because we're all feeling very nervous because we were so outnumbered, and people kept trying to come forward. And then the other team, their gunner was firing pretty frequently and pretty indiscriminately with the beanbag shots with the shotgun into the crowd, which it sprays out all these little shot pellets. And, I mean, I've never been shot with one, but from the reaction of the Iraqis getting shot with them, I assume that it hurt a lot. And also firing concussion grenades into the crowd to cause the people to disperse. And, they're Iraqis of all ages. I mean, they're all men, but there are boys there too, and old men. And when we got issued the ammunition, we had to sign these statements saying that we understood that it was to be used in a similar situation as deadly force, because that it could kill someone if it was a young person or if it hit someone in the face or things like that. So there was this possibility of death, but it became to be pretty indiscriminate and pretty frequently that we people in the unit would use this less than lethal ammunition during crowd control. So we were, and those were our orders. We have to keep these people back. And then after a few hours of that, we were told, okay, no one's going to come and get them. So destroy the vehicles, which basically, and this happened on more than one occasion, but this specific instance was light the fuel in the tankers on fire so that enough of it burns, so that it just burns away and so the Iraqis can't use it. Fire grenades into the engine blocks of the vehicles to destroy them, to make them unable to be driven anymore. And so here we were burning fuel in front of Iraqi civilians who had to wait for lines miles long just to get a little bit of fuel for their stove or for their vehicles. And it really brought home on that instance and other instances to me the complete irony and absurdity of our presence in Iraq and how, you know, I was getting letters from people saying, you know, we're so proud of you. Thank you for what you're doing over there. And then at the same time, I'm looking at people in, you know, at these Iraqi people who I can't even look in the eye because I feel so absurd and so ashamed that we're in their country risking our lives, putting their lives at jeopardy to basically guarantee a profit for Kellogg, Brown, and Root because the profit that they, I mean, you know, these vehicles, even though it represented livelihood and great wealth to the people of Iraq and to any, you know, these vehicles, they would $80,000 to $100,000 for one of these tankers full of fuel. That's a lot of money. And for the corporation, they just saw that as, you know, maybe worth life, but in the end, not even worth recovering that scrap of metal. So we were putting our lives on the line and risking violence towards the Iraqi people to protect hunks of metal and then just destroying them at the end of the day. And this happened so many times, and we were all frustrated, but at the same time, we felt like, you know, what can we do? This is what we're being ordered to do. And it really was wearing on everyone's nerves because, you know, another time we were guarding a trailer truck that had got stuck in the side of the road, and there were all these Iraqis on the other side of the road. We kept telling them, stay on the other side, stay on the other side. They kept trying to come across. Not my squad leader, but another squad leader in my platoon was getting really stressed out about it, and he said, and he was getting so frustrated that the Iraqis wouldn't stay over there, and he said, Sergeant Doherty, the next person that tries to cross this road, I want you to shoot them. And I kind of thought he was joking because seemed kind of absurd to me because we all knew that we would just end up abandoning it in a few hours anyway. And I said, you know, Sergeant, isn't that against our rules of engagement? Kind of tongue in cheek because I, you know, kind of took it as a joke. And he said, you can't do your job. Go back and monitor the radio. So, you know, we're put in a situation where we're under such intense stress and pressure where we're ready to kill people to keep them away from these vehicles when we don't even care about the vehicles because we know that we're just going to leave them. And that's the kind of situation we're put in day after day, week after week in Iraq. And on another instance, we had a flatbed truck that had been carrying a brand new ambulance to a military base that had tipped over and the ambulance had fallen on its side. And we tried for hours to try to recover the ambulance because it, other than it had fallen off the truck, it didn't seem to be that damaged. It was a brand new ambulance. And after hours, they just would not come and get it. And then we were given the order to destroy it and to burn the engine block again. And there were so many Iraqis, all the sheikhs and the local leaders from all the villages, because they were interested in, you know, if you can't recover it, we'll find a way to get that out. Because, you know, in Iraq and the area that we were, they didn't have ambulances. If someone got in a traffic accident or got hurt, the person driving by and would pick them up and put them in their car and take them to a doctor. And so we had to burn an ambulance in front of all these Iraqi people who don't even, you know, have a way to get to the hospital or have, you know, doctors to treat them when they get there. Another instance was when we had a trailer truck that had some produce in the back of it, and we were waiting and waiting and finally said, okay, just abandon it and burn it. And, you know, I remember asking my platoon leader, you know, I said, well, sir, can we let the people come get the food off of it first? And he was like, well, no, Sergeant Doherty, you know, it's just going to cause too much of a hassle because then they're all going to have to come here. They'll probably start getting in the road. We're going to have to control them when they're here and then try to get them all back. So it's just not worth it. And, you know, in a way, I mean, he was right. It wouldn't have been worth it for us because it would have caused a lot more work, a lot more danger because we've been a lot closer to the people. And so in the end, we just ended up burning the produce in front of all of these Iraqis. And at this time, I was acting as the gunner. So I was in the gun turret with the SAW machine gun, pointing it at the people over by the dirt berm at the Iraqis to keep them back so that we could burn food in front of them. And, you know, that doesn't make you, when you're in the military, you want to feel proud and you want to feel good about what you're doing. And that didn't make me feel good. That made me feel really ashamed and really confused as to what we were even doing there. And, you know, I am proud of my military service, and I was proud of it, you know, at that point. But I wasn't proud of that, and I wasn't proud of really what we were doing in Iraq. The thing that I was proud of in Iraq is that at least we were able to keep each other safe, and that's really all I could say. You know, at least we brought everyone home and no one got killed. And if that's the best that I could say and that's the best that I could take from it, and that's what I had to be proud of, but what we actually did I was ashamed of, you know, that's very distressing to me. And just the way that we were kind of put out there to be bodyguards for Kellogg, Brown, and Root, who had these drivers who drove their trucks who were from countries like India and Pakistan and the Philippines and Tibet, and they were treated horribly. These what we call TCN, third country nationals, they were lived in substandard conditions, worse than anything the U.S. contractors or American soldiers lived in. They were treated really bad and had to work much longer, had to just drive their vehicles whenever the convoy wanted to go. And I felt like I saw that as, you know, that those corporations also having a hand in dehumanizing people because they were dehumanizing the people that they were making a profit off their backs as well, you know, holding their passports and forcing them to go on the, you know, to work in Iraq under these dangerous situations. And I think one of the things that stood out to me and that I think about a lot is for every U.S. service member we have in Iraq, you know, we have a contractor, pretty much. It's a pretty even ratio. So when you think about the total occupying force in Iraq, it's not just the U.S. military. It's U.S. corporations that are there on an equal level. And the one other thing I wanted to mention before I wrap it up is that when we were leaving, getting ready to leave in February of 2004, we went back to Kuwait to Camp Arif John to get ready to come back to the States. And we were put in these tent cities that were run also by KBR. And the tents, they're canvas tents. And our tents were completely covered with mold on the insides, thick, like black mold on these yellow tents where you could see because there are all these bunk beds set up in there that we were sleeping on, and they're really these horrible rickety bunk beds. So on places where the bunk beds were and the tent sagged down and so people rubbed against it, there were just lines through this thick mold, and everyone was getting respiratory infections, and we wanted to sleep outside, but we couldn't sleep outside because we didn't have cots. They only had, you know, the bunk beds, and it was completely unhealthy place to live. It was disgusting. It was this smell that never comes out of your clothes. And now all of this stuff that I have that I had coming back from Iraq, it all smells like this mold. And this is what they were providing us, was this living condition where we couldn't even, you know, be in the place where we're supposed to live without getting sick because it was so bad. And you know, that was just, it was just like, you know, suck it up. That's what it is. That's what you're going to have to deal with. And we had to live in those tents for a couple weeks. And I guess it was just very disappointing to see how so much of what's going on in Iraq is really being driven by profit, a profit motive. And the actual human cost of the occupation is totally overlooked and totally insignificant for these corporations and for the government, who is totally supporting this policy of corporate corruption and profiteering off of the backs and the blood of Americans and the Iraqi people. So that's, thank you.
The voice of Kelly Doherty, Executive Director of Iraq Veterans Against the War and 8-year veteran of the Colorado National Guard, discussing corporate pillaging and military contractors.
Thanks, Kelly. Our next speaker is going to be Luis Montalvan. He's a member of IVW who will also be introducing himself.
Hello, I'm Captain Luis Carlos Montalvan. I joined the Army at 17 in 1990 and was a communications specialist for a couple of years before moving on to the Military Police Corps. Subsequent to serving 5 years as a military policeman, I joined the infantry and then decided to commission. So I went through the green to gold process at the University of Maryland and commissioned at Georgetown in early 2003. Went to Fort Knox, received training as a armor cavalry officer. During that time, of course, the country was at odds with respect to the necessity of the invasion, et cetera. I was skeptical, but as I've told a few reporters here and elsewhere, that being a product of the 80s and 90s, generally speaking, under administrations Reagan, Bush Sr., and Clinton, of course, there were scandals, but for the most part, we had prosperous prosperous economies. We had capable and competent leaders, and as a service member, I had no reason to doubt that that the evidence that was being collected to substantiate the necessity for an invasion of Iraq was warrantless. So, and considering the fact that General Colin Powell, who is and was esteemed so highly, testified before the UN, that kind of was pervasive in my mind as to whether or not I should, I should go. Although it's not as though I had much choice, although I could have conscientiously objected. I've been a warrior for more than half my life, so that really wasn't an option for me. The subsequent to training at Fort Knox, I was sent to Iraq in September of 2003, and I was assigned as a scout platoon leader at an area along the Syrian-Iraqi border known as Al-Walid, which is a border crossing point, also known as a port of entry. And it's one of the most strategically important POEs in general, ports of entry in general, are very strategic because, as you know, Iraq is mostly a landlocked country, and commerce and people flow through those ports of entry daily by the tens and hundreds of thousands. I was given 30 to 40 soldiers to deal with an enormous border crossing facility, to patrol 100-plus linear kilometers of Syrian-Iraqi border, and to patrol and be responsible for the security and development of between 5 and 10,000 square kilometers of Al-Anbar Desert, with 30 to 40 soldiers, and that's absolutely absurd. That drives to the heart of the lack of troops that we had there from the get-go, and the lack of troops that we didn't have in the years that went on. And that said, those of us at the tactical and operational levels consistently conveyed to our superior commanders the need for more troops, resources, et cetera, to do our job. And that essentially fell on deaf ears. Ricardo Sanchez in charge of CJTF-7 and L. Paul Bremer in charge of the CPA were wholly incompetent in their situational awareness/understanding of what was going on basically outside of Baghdad.